From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Philip Roth about his book Everyman, which is now out in paperback. It's a story of how one man faces his approaching death. One reviewer calls it a swift, brutal novel about a heartbreakingly ordinary subject. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Knocked Up, and we celebrate the 40th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band with some of our favorite cover versions of songs from that album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Philip Roth's novel, Everyman, begins at a grave in a rundown cemetery in New Jersey, where the main character is about to be buried near the graves of his parents. The novel ends with the main character's death in his 70s. In between those pages, we are told the story of his life through the story of his slow bodily decay, starting with the hernia surgery he had as a boy in 1942. Everyman is now in paperback. Reviewing the book in The New Yorker, Claudia Roth Pierpoint wrote, "Of all the subjects that Philip Roth has tackled in his career, the Jewish family, sex, American ideals, the betrayal of American ideals, political zealotry, personal identity, none have proved as inexhaustible as the human body in its strength, its frailty, and its often ridiculous need." Roth has won 2 National Book Awards, 2 National Book Critics Circle Awards, and a Pulitzer Prize. Terry spoke with Philip Roth in 2006 when the novel was released in hardback, and just after he had won a Lifetime Achievement Award from Penn, the International Literary Organization. They began with a reading from Everyman. The main character is thinking back to his father's death.
His father had become religious in the last 10 years of his life, and after having retired and having lost his wife, had taken to going to the synagogue at least once a day. Long before his final illness, he'd asked his rabbi to conduct his burial service entirely in Hebrew, as though Hebrew were the strongest answer that could be accorded death. To his father's younger son, the language meant nothing. He'd stopped taking Judaism seriously at 13, the Sunday after the Saturday of his bar mitzvah, and he had not set foot since then in a synagogue. He'd even left the space for religion blank on his hospital admission form, lest the word Jewish prompt a visit to his room by a rabbi come to talk in the way rabbis talk. Religion was a lie that he had recognized early in life, and he found all religions offensive, considered their superstitious falderal meaningless, childish, couldn't stand the complete unadultness, the baby talk and the righteousness, and the sheep, the avid believers. No hocus-pocus about death and God or obsolete fantasies of heaven for him. There was only our bodies, born to live and die on terms decided by the bodies that had lived and died before us. If he could be said to have located a philosophical niche for himself, that was it. He'd come upon it early and intuitively, and however elemental, that was the whole of it. Should he ever write an autobiography, he'd call it The Life and Death of a Male Body. But after retiring, he tried becoming a painter, not a writer, and so he gave that title to a series of his abstractions. But none of what he did or didn't believe mattered on the day that his father was buried beside his mother in the rundown cemetery just off the Jersey Turnpike.
That's Philip Roth reading from his new novel, Everyman. Philip Roth, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your Pen Nabokov Award. Now, you know, the title that this man in your novel would have given his autobiography had he written one was The Life and Death of a Male Body, and it's kind of the title you could have given your book if you wanted to, because your book is about the slow deterioration of one man and his body, starting with his hernia surgery as a boy, and it's also about the sexual urges of that body, which sometimes lead him in the wrong direction. I mean, the body is kind of a real problem for him. It's of course, the symbol of his mortality, but what did you want to write about a life as the story of one man's mortal body?
First of all, it occurred to me. These ideas arise spontaneously, you know. But to add to that, I didn't know of a book which was formulated out of a medical history, as this one is. I knew of some books that were about illness and disease, though very few, by the way, that I could think of. Maybe others can think of more, but the great ones we know, Mann's Magic Mountain, which is about a tuberculosis sanatorium, and Solzhenitsyn's great work, The Cancer Ward, and Tolstoy's short novel, a masterpiece, really, The Death of Ivan Ilyich. But beyond that, there are very few books I knew of that were about illness to begin with. But none that I knew of where the narrative line was really a medical history. And for so many people, especially as they age in our society today, their medical biography is their biography. So that's what gave me the idea to just stick to his medical history and see his progress through life in terms of that.
In the reading that you just did, the main character, Everyman, explains that he considers religion superstitious folderol, meaningless and childish. But there's nothing in his life to replace religion. Like, he discards religion, but there's nothing real to hold on to in his life. There's no real larger philosophy or even passion that he can hold on to as his body starts to diminish. Do you see that as a problem for people who reject religion? Like, what do you find to replace it with?
No, I personally think religion is the problem. So I don't see it as a problem. No, I wanted to write about what seemed to me far from unordinary, which is a secular life. I think that probably despite the period we're going through in America now, that essentially it is a secular country and that people lead deeply secular lives, and in many ways the glory of America is its secularism, to my mind. But I was neither glorifying him nor assailing him or doing anything in terms of his beliefs. I wanted this man to face death the way I think most people do, and that is without the consolation or comforts that come from religious belief. He faces it head on with no belief in any divine presence, no belief certainly in an afterlife, but death is there and it is oblivion.
Your character describes the process of becoming less and less as he gets older and older, the aimless days and the uncertain nights and the impotently putting up with the physical deteriorating and the terminal sadness and the waiting and waiting for nothing. And I think what emphasizes for him this period of waiting for nothing and this process of becoming less and less is that after he retires, he has this kind of vacuum in his life. You know, he's no longer married. He's divorced. Two of his three children really don't like him. He always fantasized that when he retired, he'd paint. And he'd have all this, like, uninterrupted time to paint. But after doing that for a while, he decides he's not very good and he's not really enjoying it. He's lonely. He tries life in a retirement community, but he doesn't like that. But when he moves out, he's lonely. So, you know, I think the book is in part about that part of life after retirement. Like, what do you do with it? What does he do with it? Have you been thinking about that a lot? You're not from a profession from which you retire. you're still writing.
No, you just drop dead at the computer and they carry you away. Well, I haven't been thinking about it in any personal way, no, because I intend to write for as long as I possibly can. But other people are not so fortunate or unfortunate in their professions. And it's very common that men and women who have been working all their lives suddenly stop at age 65 or 70 or 72, whatever. And they are confronted with a huge problem, which is what will life be filled with? And I did want to think about that. He does have an ambition, as you say, to paint, which he wants to fulfill after retirement. And he begins with great enthusiasm. In fact, as you know, in the book, he even gives a class or two, I think, in painting to other members of this sort of affluent retirement community. But that peters out for reasons that are explained in the book. And there is a great void. There is a great emptiness. And the problem with the void isn't the void itself. It's that it's accompanied by this medical deterioration. So you have to see the two things together, I think, in the story of this man. By the way, you call him Everyman, which is perfectly all right with me. But as you know, in fact, I don't call him Everyman. That's the title, indeed. We can talk about that. But he's nameless throughout, and a very good friend of mine, who's a very good reader, called me to tell me she didn't know he was nameless till I mentioned it on a radio program that she was listening to. So I think it can go unnoticed, the fact that he has no name. It isn't something that I emphasize. It's just there. But he isn't called Everyman, though his father, as you know, has a jewelry store in Elizabeth, New Jersey, And rather than using his own Jewish name on the jewelry store, whatever name that might have been, he feels that he can have more success than Elizabeth if he calls it Every Man's Jewelry Store.
Why didn't you give your main character a name?
Well, first time round writing this story, I didn't have a name for the character. It just didn't occur to me to give him a name. I was struggling with the story. You take things in stages. And I wrote, 60 or 70 pages, which was the entire story, but was only a rough first draft, and there was no name. And then on rereading it, it seemed to me it was a good idea to have him nameless, not for any spectacular reason, you know, but rather he's defined more by the matrix of relationships with others than he is by a name. That is to say, he's his parents' child. He's his brother's brother. He's his wife's husband. He's his daughter's father. He's his boss's worker, etc. So he's defined by his relation to others. And it seemed to me as I was writing that indeed that's the way we are defined, really. Our names are convenient handles. But I wanted to emphasize that. And I thought if he didn't have a name, that would be helpful. In addition, the everyman aspect came into it, too. I don't mean that he's a universal figure. I don't mean he's an allegorical figure by any means. But rather, he is every man in as much as he signs the contract, the bad contract we all sign and fulfill, which is that you're born to live and you die. And in that sense, he is every man and every woman. And as you know, by the way, every man is the name, title of a 15th century English play, part of that genre called morality plays. It's probably the greatest piece of writing in the medieval period. It's deeply allegorical. And the main character is called Every Man, and Death appears as Death, and other characters such as Fellowship and Kindred and Knowledge and Beauty, etc., appear. So the virtues and the vices are all personified in the old play Every Man. My book is not an allegory. I have no allegorical intentions. But I did borrow the title of that allegory from my realistic novel.
Philip Roth, speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Philip Roth. His latest novel, Everyman, is now out in paperback.
The novel opens at a funeral service where we learn a little bit about all this character's connections to his family. He's buried where his parents are buried, and the cemetery is run down. You're right. Things have rotted and toppled over. The gates are rusted. The locks are gone. There's been vandalism. Now, in other books, you've written about, like, you know, the old neighborhood being run down. And this is kind of like the parallel. The old cemetery is run down. I wonder what your feelings are about cemeteries. Like, do you visit, like, your parents' graves? Do you feel closer to the dead when you're at the cemetery?
Yes, I do visit the gravesite of my mother and father. Yes, I do feel closer to, if not to the dead, to their memories when I'm there. I'm rather glad that my parents were buried in the ground in a box and not cremated and and their ashes scattered somewhere. It gives me a place to go. I don't believe they're present. I know they're dead. But somehow the place has a significance. It focuses your thinking. It allows you to be alone and uninterrupted in your thinking about them and your past with them and who they were. And I don't do it more than once a year, but I do it regularly, and it doesn't mean a great deal to me.
So do you have like a plot picked out? Do you know what kind of cemetery or where you'd want to be buried?
Where would it be easiest for you to visit my grave? And I'll pick up a plot. That's convenient. And we can continue this interview series on into eternity.
Yeah. But do you want to be buried? I mean, I have the sense that, like, cemeteries in their own way are almost outdated, you know, because people are so scattered all over the place geographically, friends and family, and they're not tied together in a physical community anymore. And cemeteries, I don't know, they seem like you need to, like, take care of the neighborhood. You know, you go in there and it's as if, like, you bought this home for somebody in a neighborhood, and it's like, is it a nice neighborhood? Is the neighborhood being kept up? What are the neighbors like? And it's just this, like, weird way sometimes of thinking of the dead.
Well, I feel differently. As recently as last February, I guess, I visited the gravesite of my mother and father. And also buried there are many members of my mother's family, my grandmother, my grandfather on her side, their brothers and sisters. Those are great aunts and great uncles. So one of my mother's sisters, and so on. So I wander around, and I find, to repeat what I said earlier, that my attention is focused by virtue of those gravestones and those dates that I see. They're very powerful. They're very powerful, those dates you see on a gravestone. It's just four numbers and a hyphen and four more numbers, but they pack a punch, you know. And especially the older parts of the cemetery, I find quite interesting. In fact, I write about that in the book. There's quite a bit of history in those gravestones. You see how long people lived in a certain era. You see, as I did, the bunching together of deaths in 1918. You realize it was the influenza epidemic. You see the age. You see the graves of children and even infants, which you rarely see in our era, but they were more than plentiful, alas, in the beginning of the 20th century. So I find cemeteries quite interesting, and what isn't outdated?
Did you have to put yourself into a certain mood to write this book? I mean, every time I'd pick up this book, it would really get me into that mood of just thinking about, you know, mortality, my own, my friends, you know, families. It's just so drenched in that. And I can only imagine what it must have been like to actually sit and write this book. So did you have to, like, go into a certain frame of mind each day when you sat down to continue writing?
Well, not much different from the frame of mind I have to enter into with any book, really. I wasn't living the experience. I was trying to make a literary object out of it. And I had the same problems to deal with that I would deal with in writing any book, which is to see the thing as clearly as I could, to find the incidents and events that would most vividly deal with mortality, to make a family, to invent a family, to invent their relationships, to invent. That's what I would say. The subject doesn't change the task. And I guess in a way you're also asking, was I particularly grim and gloomy and despairing when I wrote it? Only when the book was going badly was I those things. It was an act of writing. It wasn't an act of grieving.
No, I know, but still, to get into the subject that you're writing about, I'd imagine you had to like focus your thoughts a lot on mortality, on death, on the slow diminishment of the body over time, on pain, illness. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what you were writing about. You had to be thinking about it.
Well, sure. But it's all around one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you see it every day, and people who aren't writers have other tasks, and their task is not to necessarily to look at that. This is no judgment on the way people go about their lives, but it's really the task of the writer to look at this stuff that is not so pretty.
Philip Roth speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. His latest novel, Everyman, is now out in paperback. It just added to Roth's pile of prizes. Penn has given Everyman the 2007 award for fiction, making Roth the first writer to receive that award 3 times. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement. Online at TIAACREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Philip Roth. David Edelstein reviews Knocked Up, and we celebrate the 40th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by playing our favorite cover versions of songs from the album. This isn't one of them.
When I get older, losing my head.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Philip Roth, one of the most acclaimed living American writers. His books include Portnoy's Complaint, The Human Stain, and The Plot Against America. His new novel, Everyman, follows one man's life and death through the story of his body and his breakdowns and failures.
When you're writing a book, do you have everything mapped out before you start? Do you know the fate of all the characters? Do you know what urges will lead them astray and where their fulfillment will be if they ever find it, mm-hmm. and how they'll interconnect and what surprises are going to happen and overturn their expectations?
I know that when I hand the book in to the publisher.
But not before?
No, I don't know anything in the beginning. Which makes it great fun to write, you know. You don't know anything. You don't even know how to write. So you begin every book as an amateur and as a dummy. And in the writing, you discover the book. Of course, you're in charge. But gradually, by writing sentence after sentence, the book, as it were, reveals itself through you to your language, through your language, rather. So each sentence is a revelation. I'm not exaggerating. Each and every sentence is a revelation. And what you're trying to do is hook one sentence to the sentence before and to the next one to that sentence. And as you do, you're building a house, you know? And the architect and the contractor, they know what the house will look like when it's done, and that's a big difference. I don't have any idea what it will look like when it's done. I don't have any idea whether it will even be done. Because you don't know what you're doing when you're at work, which is to say that I don't know the answers to those questions you raise.
There was an article about you recently in the New York Times by Chip McGrath, and there's a quote that you said to him that I really want to read here. You said, "If you're lucky, your grandparents will die when you're, say, in college. If you're lucky, your parents will live until you're somewhere in your 50s or 60s. And your children will never die before you. That's the deal. But in this contract, nothing is written about your friends. So when they start dying, it's a gigantic shock." When did that shock start happening to you?
Well, probably 25 years ago with friends who died relatively young. But it's gathered momentum in recent years, because usually one's friends vary in age from maybe being 15 to 20 years older than you and being 15 to 20 years younger than you. So the people I knew, say, when I was in my 30s who were in their 50s are now people in their 90s or they're dead. And those deaths begin to pile up. And the death of friends is a very, very difficult thing to come to grips with. I think I'm not the first person to notice this, by the way. There's a line in a Yeats poem where he's speaking about some of the harsher experiences of old age, and he speaks of the death of friends. So I think that it isn't so much when it began, because sure, there's someone who unfortunately dies young, but when you reach your 60s, and your 70s, then the winnowing out takes place.
What are some of the things that strike you as emotionally different about the death of friends than the death of family?
Well, I think we could begin with what I said to Chip. We all know, we don't think about it, but we all know that the scheme is grandparents go, and then parents go, and then, as I said to him, one thing you did left out is we don't die. So, and then, but one's children certainly never go before you. That's the fairy tale. Mm-hmm. The actuality is that there's no rhyme nor reason to the dying. But in my thinking, friends never figured in it. Your friends are your friends for life, as it were. You're all in this thing together. You're equals. We call them your peers, your contemporaries. I don't know what fosters this illusion. I'm not saying it's not stupid to think this way, but it's one of those human illusions you have, and you have a kind of feeling for friends unlike the feeling you have for family. And you're quite astonished, I think, by the depth of the feeling when someone dies, what you felt for a friend. And also the reestimation, which happens when someone dies, happens all the time with friends, I think. I don't mean that you suddenly say, gosh, he was a wonderful fellow, and I always thought he was a son of a bitch. Not that. Nothing as crude as that. But rather you suddenly see them clearly, vividly, and it's very strong medicine.
In the reading that you did at the beginning of our interview, your main character dismisses religion as being superstition, as being childish. Is there any part of you that ever wishes that you were a believer, that you were like a man of faith and believed in some kind of, you know, like eternal spirit after death, and believed?
I have no desire to be irrational.
What a lot of people say would be, you know, like, well, it might be irrational, but it doesn't make it, like, rationality only goes so far in this world.
If only it went further in this world.
So there isn't any part of you at all that, like, wishes that you could believe.
I have no taste for delusion.
And was it always that way, that you never had a taste for
delusion, yes.
Your parents, did they believe?
I don't know, really. They were deeply identified themselves as Jews for historical, genealogical, social reasons, and family reasons and community reasons. They were powerfully identified as Jews, but theologically, I wonder. I wonder, really. I don't know.
Since your book is so much about mortality and one man's process of slowly reaching death, I'm wondering if you believe in that expression, a good death. Do you think that there's such a thing as a good death?
What does that mean exactly?
Well, I guess I would think that it means, I mean, to me it means probably not dying this really long, painful kind of death, but also, you know, kind of facing it with some degree of, you know, acceptance. And I don't know.
Well, I don't know that I can answer that question. Each death is different.
Mm-hmm.
Each person suffers death differently. For some, it's physically agonizing. For some, it's not physically agonizing. I'd be hesitant about the adjective. There are different deaths, I would say, rather than a good one or a bad one. I mean, of course, I can recognize if someone's in great physical agony, that's not what one would choose. But as for the second thing you talk about, which is accepting, oh boy, that's asking a lot. You're confronting,
yeah.
After all, one is confronting that which one has feared all one's life. Think of all the things you feared in life and add them up and then multiply it by 1,000, and now you're confronting that. So I wouldn't judge anyone's response to dying by words like, I know you didn't suggest these words, but courage or cowardice, or I reserve judgment on that. It's the hardest thing of all to face. Didn't Henry James say when he was dying, "Here it is, the great thing"?
Philip Roth, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. His newest novel, Everyman, is now out in paperback. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein on Knocked Up. This is Fresh Air. Judd Apatow wrote and directed the new screwball comedy Knocked Up. Apatow worked on some of TV's most groundbreaking comedies, among them The Larry Sanders Show and Freaks and Geeks, before his movie success with The 40-Year-Old Virgin. In Knocked Up, he casts many of his old Freaks and Geeks actors in a very different kind of story. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The premise of Knocked Up is as blunt, as basic as its title. Katherine Heigl of Grey's Anatomy plays Allison, an attractive and newly successful TV correspondent who becomes pregnant after a drunken one-night stand with Ben, played by Seth Rogen. Despite the advice of her mother and friends to get an abortion, Allison chooses both to have the baby and to bond with its father, which is no easy task, given that Ben is an unholy monument to self-indulgence. He's slovenly, he's unemployed, and he shares a sty with unhygienic stoners who tinker with building a website that documents nude scenes of famous actresses, but who mostly hover over their bong. The writer and director, Judd Apatow, has carved out a niche that I envy. He makes films about backward boy men driven to face up to their adult responsibilities, but along the way, he gets to wallow in their geekiness and childishness and druggy dissolution. He gets to keep a foot in both worlds. Knocked Up is very conventional, and its values are conservative, maybe even reactionary, but it plays like one of the hippest movies ever made. Apatow can show riotous scenes of getting drunk and stoned and having unprotected sex and leering at naked babes on the internet because his movie builds to a message of nuclear family and baby worship. Freaks and Geeks freaks will recognize Rogen, along with Martin Starr and Jason Segel and James Franco in a cameo as himself. And they'll know that Apatow's heart is with this overweight eyesore Ben, even when the camera lingers on Rogen's huge buttocks as Allison gazes on him in horror the morning after. Of course, it's improbable that they'd pair up in the first place, as in Sideways, the idea of a tall drink-of-water blonde falling into bed with a pudgy, penniless, alcoholic dweeb suggests wishful thinking on the part of male filmmakers. Listen to Allison's attempt to get to know the father of her child.
I'm Canadian.
Oh, that's cool.
From Vancouver. I live here illegally, actually. Don't tell anyone. But it works out in my advantage, I think, ultimately, because I don't have to pay any taxes. So financially, that's helpful, because I don't have a lot of money, you know. I mean, I'm not poor or anything, but I eat a lot of spaghetti.
So, you know, the webpage or whatever is just something that you guys do for fun. Do you have a real job?
Well, that is our job.
Oh.
We don't technically get money for the hours we put in, but it is our job.
So how do you...
How do I pay rent? When I was in high school, I got ran over by a postal truck.
Oh, my God.
It was my foot more than anything. But I got like 14 grand from the British Columbia government.
Right.
And that really lasted me. I mean, until now. I mean, it's been almost 10 years. I have like 900 bucks left. So that should last me for like, I mean, I'm not a mathematician, but like another 2 years.
Ben is appalling, but he doesn't exist in a vacuum. Apatow depicts the rest of Allison's life as a tiptoe among unruly brats, from the whiny celebrity she interviews on the E! Network to her affluent sister Deb, played by Leslie Mann, and brother-in-law Pete, played by Paul Rudd. Deb and Pete represent marital stability and seethe with loathing for each other. It's against the ghastly example of their marriage and the obsession with skinniness of her network employers that Allison decides to have her baby. Knocked Up bogs down as it approaches the two-hour point, which ought to be the outer limit for a screwball comedy. This one is 2 1/4, and each new section begins with a high-resolution shot of an actual growing fetus. For all the baby worship, though, Apatow never explores Allison's decision to go ahead with the pregnancy, and he has little to say about the struggles, economic and otherwise, of single motherhood. For better or worse, this feels like a post-Roe v. Wade-era movie. The message is that there's never a reason to terminate a pregnancy. Wow, I've gotten so serious. And the movie isn't, at least on the surface. As Apatow explores the question of how to build and sustain a family in a culture obsessed with youth and freedom and fantasies of escape, the banter is bruisingly funny. The characters brilliantly childish. Apatow's wife, Leslie Mann, gives the breakout performance, her voice all girlish and purring until it builds to a fusillade of expletives at her clueless husband. Heigl is a great Alice in a wonderland of loons, and Rogan never lets Ben get too cuddly. His aversion to commitment is instinctive. He's the perfect mascot for Apatow's universe, dragged into adulthood by his sperm, one side stoned, the other sober, the Janus head of the modern male.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, a non-military salute to Sergeant Pepper. This is Fresh Air. I know I'm the TV critic here, but nothing in pop culture excites me like the Beatles. Nothing. I'm addicted. The albums, the books, the bootlegs, the Cirque du Soleil show. I've scarfed them all up and more. When I was asked to bring in my favorite Sgt. Pepper covers to play on Fresh Air to honor the album's 40th anniversary, well, let's just say it was an easy day's night. We'll start with the title track, recorded in concert only 2 days after Sgt. Pepper's was released by someone who loved it so much he couldn't wait to play it live, Jimi Hendrix. It was 20 years ago today. Sgt. Pepper told the band to play. Then comes one of the most famous Beatles cover versions ever, arranged by Leon Russell and performed by Joe Cocker, with a little help from my friends from 1969. Next song on Sgt. Pepper, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, became a number one hit when Elton John recorded it in 1974. But he had help. The rhythm guitar on that session was credited to Dr. Winston O'Boogie, but his real name was John Lennon. Picture yourself in a boat on a river, tangerine trees, a marmalade sky. Quite slowly, a girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Those last two were gimmies. Now it gets tougher. The best version of Getting Better is from an unlikely source. The British group Gomez, who recorded their cover in 2000 at Abbey Road, where Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr recorded the original. I used to be cruel to my woman. I beat her and kept her apart from the things that she loved. Thank you. The next track on Sgt. Pepper's is Fixing a Hole. My favorite cover of this song is from a jazz vocalist in Minneapolis. Her name is Connie Evingson, and she recorded this in 2003 on Let It Be Jazz, a CD full of wonderful Beatles covers.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in, stops my mind from wandering where it will go.
Jimi Hendrix wasn't the only performer to rush out and cover a song from Sgt. Pepper when the album came out in 1967. Harry Nilsson did it too, by covering She's Leaving Home that same year. The Beatles loved it, and liked Harry too. He and John Lennon became infamous drinking buddies in the mid-70s, and even recorded an album together. But here's Harry Nilsson on his own with She's Leaving Home.
We never thought of ourselves.
She's leaving.
Never thought for ourselves.
Oh.
We struggled hard all our lives.
The reason why I can't stop collecting Beatles covers is that they keep coming. And this one just arrived this spring. It's an amazing cover of George Harrison's Within You, Without You by Patti Smith.
We were talking about the space between us all and the people who hide.
The version I like of Lovely Rita was one of the hardest recordings to track down. It's from a British charity compilation from 1988 called Sgt. Pepper Knew My Father, and got very limited release. I finally tracked down an audio cassette copy on eBay from somebody in England, but it was worth it.
Lovely Rita, meet a man. Nothing can come between us. When it gets dark, show my heart away. Standing by the parking meter. When I caught a glimpse of Rita, filling in a ticket in a little white book. In a cast,
it's by Michelle Schacht, who's from Texas, not England. Not only is it a fabulous rendition, but the fact that she's a woman singing about a sexy female meter maid gives the song a sly lesbian subtext, at least to me. The next song on the original Sgt. Pepper album is Good Morning, Good Morning. And here's a good modern version by a group called the Lolas.
Nothing to do to save his life, call his wife in. Nothing to say but what a day, how's your boy been? Nothing to do, it's up to you. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
The Beatles performed the title song twice on Sgt. Pepper, but we'll skip right to the famous final song, A Day in the Life. This is the novelty version, but a brilliant one. A group called Big Daddy specializes in imitating the styles of vintage rock performers. And in 1992, Big Daddy released its own version of Sgt. Pepper. Each song was sung in the style of a famous pop star. Jerry Lee Lewis doing Lucy in the Sky, Johnny Mathis doing With a Little Help from My Friends, stuff like that. Big Daddy closed the album, as the Beatles did, with A Day in the Life, but imagined it as Buddy Holly might have recorded it.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the great pay. And though the news was rather sad, well, I just had to laugh. I saw the photograph.
Buddy Holly, of course, died in a plane crash before the Beatles made their first record, but somehow this sounds right. Here's their version of the famous ending. where that unforgettable final piano chord is approximated by a sound that's even more ominous. Happy 40th birthday, Sergeant Pepper. I know I skipped a couple songs, but I wanted to save time for a little something extra. Because why stop at Sergeant Pepper or at 1967? After all, if it's the 40th anniversary of Sergeant Pepper, that means it's 45 years since the Beatles first hit the charts with Love Me Do. And that gives me the excuse to play one of my favorite Beatle covers of all time. It's Love Me Do, all right, but as performed by a rarely heard group called the Beatle Barkers. When you hear this, you'll understand why. Prepare to be stunned. Special thanks to Jonathan Minhivar for putting that tribute together. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Roberta Schrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Spellbound, The Surprising Origins and Astonishing Secrets of English Spelling by James Essinger, and from the Criterion Collection, presenting a 2-DVD special edition of The Third Man, starring Orson Welles, in stores now at Criterion.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the life and work of Hitler's favorite filmmaker, Leni Riefenstahl. We talk with her biographer, Stephen Bach. Join us for the next Fresh Air.